tiny in all that air. The Philip Larkin Society Podcast.
If my darling were once to decide not to stop at my eyes, but to jump like Alice with floating skirt into my head, she would find no tables and chairs, no mahogany claw-footed sideboards, no undisturbed embers. The tantalus would not be filled, nor the fender seat cozy, nor the shelves stuffed with small printed books for the Sabbath, nor the butler bibulous, the housemaids lazy. She would find herself looped with the creep of varying light, monkey brown, fish grey, a string of infected circles, loitering like bullies about to coagulate. Delusions that shrink to the size of a woman's glove, then sicken inclusively outwards. She would also remark the unwholesome floor, as it might be the skin of a grave, from which ascends an adhesive sense of betrayal. A Grecian statue kicked in the privates, money, a swill tub of finer feelings. But most of all, she'd be stopping her ears against the incessant recital intoned by reality, larded with technical terms, each one double-yoked with meaning and meaning's rebuttal. For the skirl of that bulletin unpicks the world like a knot. And to hear how the past is past and the future neuter might knock my darling off her unpriceable pivot.
And welcome to Tiny in All That Air, the Philip Larkin Society podcast. My name is Lynn Lockwood and I'm the Deputy Chair of the Philip Larkin Society. Thank you for joining us for this episode, which we have called Horror Larkin. It's a show I've been wanting to do for a long time, as I'm a big fan of anything strange and sinister. Although this isn't always what comes to mind when people think about Larkin, but there are many times in his writing that he presents us with unsettling imagery, from the shadowy and ghostly to the downright terrifying. And of course, Larkin himself chose to be photographed in the atmospheric Hull General Cemetery at Springbank for the cover of the vinyl recordings of The Less Deceived. Carrying a torch and a flask of strong tea to keep our spirits up, I'm joined by Mr. James from the Writing the Schoolies podcast and Alex Howard, a trustee of the Philip Larkin Society, who has recently published his book on Philip Larkin called, spookily enough, Larkin's Travelling Spirit. We begin by discussing just what we mean by the word horror.
The thing that struck me just reading up for this and reminded myself of some of the teaching I've done around horror and the gothic is just so how overdefined it is. There seems to be no limit of the amount of people writing and trying to define the gothic. It's just spilling with all of these definitions. I suppose if you try to get the top five, it would be preoccupied with the old, madness, an opposition to sort of rationality, I suppose, because it was coming around in that time to sort of kick back against neoclassicism. So it was very sort of eccentric and oblique, and very much a sort of preoccupation with mental state doubling. And it obviously had many areas, architecture, literature, art, and all of that. But I suppose when you think about horror, what comes to my mind is film, you know, and the more sort of broad definition comes to mind of just things that are scary, terrifying, unsettling. And it seems an incredibly useful thing to attribute to Larkin. And in a way, I'm quite surprised that more people haven't done it. You know, if not the Gothic, which I think has a lot of currency on Larkin, but just horror in general, because it seems to be dripping with different types of horror. I think If My Darling, which we're going to discuss, definitely seems like a meditation on the horrific bodily malformations, as does things like Sonny Prestatyn. And then there are things in The North Ship, which are very much just like your typical nightmarish scenarios are played out. A girl being dragged by the wrists, all of these kind of slightly the stuff that is the meat of the 1960s and 70s horrific film genre. It seems to be kind of, Larkin is always sort of dabbling in it. I'm just interested to see if you guys sort of feel the same, really. But it definitely, when there was a chance for a horror Larkin podcast, I thought, gosh, yeah, there's so much here, and it's not really been talked about enough in Larkin.
Yeah, because when I've always thought about doing like a horror Larkin, but it always felt a bit tongue-in-cheek, really. And thinking about the Sylvia Plath horror poet essay, you know, this he didn't really see himself as a horror writer. And you know, obviously he wouldn't have seen himself in that way. It's not really a word that comes up very much in his writing. So I'm not going to go concordance crazy, but I've just very recently acquired an actual concordance.
Oh, lovely.
Which is going to transform my analysis and make me sound terribly whizzy. Just to set this in context in terms of Larkin and the word horror, he actually only uses the word horror twice in his poetry, and that's both really early, like in 1950, and the word horrify as well, and horrors all come really, really early, and then he never comes back to it again until which poem?
Ooh, that'd be Old Bard, I believe.
The Old Bard, yeah. Which I thought was fascinating, that he didn't use that word again in any of his poetry until Old Bard.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But there is a lot of horror in Larkin, I agree. And I really like the that kind of out of reach horror, that sort of intangible horror, like the horror of Mr. Bleeny, you know, the kind of the edge of town horror and the horror of sort of domesticity and you know, failure is in there as well. And I think it's a kind of, maybe for modern sensibilities, where we see horror, you know, in the everyday, I think appeals a lot to us in Larkin. So Joe, what's your view of horror then?
Well, to come at it from a slightly different angle, because Alex is spot on, of course, with the Gothic being a musing typically on things like dreams, the subconscious. You know, you could look at it from the psychology. You could also look at it as a reaction to the sublime, of course, at one point, all of those things. But the thing that has always really stuck with me, I remember studying High Windows when I was at sixth form. And I remember distinctly picking up The Old Fools. And yeah, I thought it was really, really affecting, that line, you know, why aren't they screaming? You know, and as somebody who would regularly be traveling to visit my grandfather, who was sadly in a nursing home and, you know, was not a well man at all. Yeah, it hit home in a way. And certainly that's one of the poems that I've earmarked as a reminder that it's the horror of your circumstances. And there seems to be a bit of a recurring theme of Larkin's poetic speakers being people caught in circumstances that they didn't intend to be. And there is that sense of not, in life, I think we like to put things off and say, well, that won't happen to me. That will happen to somebody else. Yeah. And I think Larkin's very, very good at drawing you back into going, but it might well be you. And if it is, what will you do?
Of course, that final line in The Old Fools, of course, we shall find out.
Yes.
He brings everyone in. Everyone is implicit and everyone is going to... He's almost too confident. You know, people could, of course, be hit by buses and not succumb to a slow decline. But he really makes it clear that we're all going to, you know, have this unifyingly awful sort of descent and decrepitude of faculties over time. Which is horrific, isn't it? It's just, in a broad sense, horrific.
Yeah.
So in a way, I suppose that's part of it for me. The other thing that I think good horror, generally speaking, whatever it might be, cinema or stories, there's a dark humour that I think has to exist, or if you have unrelenting bleakness, it can actually become quite amusing after a while. The bathos really starts to come out and it's no longer bad. You know, one of the finest writers still living is Stephen King, certainly his early stuff. We're talking really early and sort of middle King, not the stuff that he's done recently, but the idea of all of his characters in the best of his novels and novellas are very likable. There's humor, there's wit, which makes us care about them, and we can't be frightened if we don't care, you know. And I think a lot of Larkin's speakers, even the ones that are deliberately unsympathetic. We mentioned Bleeny. You know, I've got this really, really clear picture of what he looks like in my head. I'm sure we all do, and it will be slightly different. But my Mr. Bleeny breaks my heart every time I think of him sitting there in his tomb of a room.
Yeah.
So, and it's that. It's all of those things that we've talked about, and you know, you can link that then, of course, with the gothic sort of tropes of isolation, nature turning against you, etc. So yeah,
I think that comedy aspect is really important. The more I think of what Joe just said there, the fact that, you know, really good horror or terror has to have comedy in tow, otherwise it becomes farcical, and it's actually the characters that are most horrific as well who are the most engaging, obviously often because of wit, because wit and humor and urbanity and, you know, eloquence often goes hand in hand with people who are manipulative. Just think of Paradise Lost. You know, Paradise Lost is all about good and evil, but it's the devil who you want to read. He's the compelling voice. God's actually really boring, because actually virtue and the right path is actually quite dull and pedestrian. What's exciting and what resonates with our psyche and the Jekyll and Hyde in all of us is transgression and how particularly language and voice and rhetoric can be used to harness transgression and use it as a sort of power. And the more I think about it, there is actually also with Larkin's horror, Larkin's comic voice. It's always sort of, I struggled a little bit to find it in The Old Fools, although I think...
See, I do see it. Me and people find The Old Fools funny at times. Yeah. It can strike us. Just that bit at the beginning, don't they somehow suppose it's more grown up when his mouth hangs open and drools? That, you know, and in fact, why aren't they screaming? Mm. There's something almost like childish about it, you know. There's like it's a very complex tone to that, I think.
And the insults that he sort of throws with the ash hair, toad hands, prune face. There's an element of sort of, it's that kind of thing that you do when you're a kid, and you say horrible things about people, but people just go, "Oh, it's only a kid saying it." And yet, for me, the real horror in The Old Fools, or the line that gets me horror-wise, besides the "why aren't they screaming," is the continuous questioning of "not at night" and then "not when the strangers come." Mm. There's something about that line that I really find very affecting. Because it's so opaque. Which strangers? Yeah. Who? Yeah. Are we talking the men in white coats, or are we talking something far more beyond the realm of this mortal coil? I don't know, but it's glorious, I think.
Yeah, there's lots of metaphors for sort of figures of death in Larkin. I like the boy in Atgrass, you know, the groom's boy that comes to take the horses away.
Yeah.
Gentle figure of death at the end.
The reason I'm sort of coming to this poem is because it never really quite loses its power. And some things should, because you do them so many times, you read them so many times, or you, but no, it just continues for me. I don't know why. And certainly it's just this, I think I said it on my podcast when I did the thing for Larkin's birthday, it was saying, you know, the thing that I'll always think of, a teacher described this poem as a bit like somebody walking around a room, shutting out every single source of light they could possibly find.
Yeah.
And doing it so relentlessly and so sort of completely that, again, this actually lacks humour, which is its only flaw, I think. There isn't quite there. Although it has, it lacks humour in some areas where I feel that it's almost a bit of a victim of its own success and how bleak it is. Mm. But yeah. All right, I'll give it a whirl, and yeah. We can discuss it straight after. I work all day and get half drunk at night. Waking at 4 to soundless dark, I stare. In time, the curtain edges will grow light. Till then, I see what's really always there. Unresting death. A whole day nearer now, making all thought impossible, but how and where and when I shall myself die. Arid interrogation, yet the dread of dying and being dead flashes afresh to hold and horrify. The mind blanks at the glare, not in remorse, the good not done, the love not given, time torn off unused, nor wretchedly because an only life can take so long to climb clear of its wrong beginnings and may never. For extinction that we travelled to, and shall be lost in always. Not to be here, not to be anywhere, and soon, nothing more terrible, nothing more true. This is a special way of being afraid. No trick dispels. Religion used to try, that vast moth-eaten musical brocade created to pretend we never die, and spacious stuff that says no rational being can fear a thing it will not feel, not seeing that this is what we fear. No sight, no sound, no touch or taste or smell. Nothing to think with, nothing to love or link with. The anesthetic from which none come round. And so it stays just on the edge of vision. A small, unfocused blur, a standing chill that slows each impulse down to indecision. Most things may never happen. This one will. And realization of it rages out. In furnace fear when we are caught without people or drink. Courage is no good. It means not scaring others. Being brave lets no one off the grave. Death is no different wind at than withstood. Slowly, light strengthens and the room takes shape. It stands plain as a wardrobe. What we know, have always known that we can't escape, yet can't accept. One side will have to go. Meanwhile, telephones crouch, getting ready to ring in locked up offices, and all the uncaring, intricate, rented world begins to rouse. The sky is white as clay, with no sun. Work has to be done. Postmen, like doctors, go from house to house. I mean, it always reminds me, as I go through it, it's such a journey, this poem. Not being all that long, it's got such density to it. And I do remember the first time reading this, and almost being, there's so much in here, there's so many sort of diffuse images that I almost had to go back and read it all over again, and then again, and it was, again, only when I'd sort of started to memorize and sort of recite parts of it that I began to feel some some elements of this more keenly than before. I'd rather hear from you guys where you think the horror sort of most obviously stands out, and then I'll tell you what I think, because I'm aware I've had a lot of time on the mic.
I'll tell you one thing, a couple of things that have struck me. It's always different every time I read this poem, to be honest. Certainly earlier on this week, I walked out into the garden and the sky was white as clay with no sun. It absolutely was. And it is a very eerie feeling to have that, like, absence of sun, even though you know it's daylight. And you know what you were saying about blocking off all your, like, ways out. And this isn't the morning where you just get up and it's all, oh, it's fine, the birds are singing, it's all fine. The morning still brings the fear. The fear is still there. And the telephone crouching, there are quite a lot of, like, ghost stories about haunted telephone lines. And the kind of, and especially the 1970s telephone, where it was the big black telephone that rang very loudly. I think as in 2021, we've lost a little bit of the cultural context of this poem. And my kids, one's 15, one's 24. And they didn't really grow up very much with proper house telephones. I don't really remember it that much. But I do remember the 24-year-old having a toy, like, proper telephone, like an old-fashioned dial telephone, and it was a toy one that had a cord. And you could actually ring it from the other end. And she got totally freaked out by it in case it rang once without us doing it. She became really frightened of the phone. And I think about how now we don't have the telephone next to the bed like we used to. We don't, like, we switch our phones off at night or put them on silent when we won't get that midnight call, knowing, you know, after an emergency or an accident or something. And even in offices, this is something that's disappearing, isn't it? The telephone that you answer. One thing that totally captivated me this week was with the white sky, and I could really understand that. But also, I feel as we move away from 1977, this becomes culturally a more of a historical artifact as a poem, which is interesting. And where we locate horror changes, doesn't it, as each generation changes?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, that the locus of horror does seem to shift. Is it the body? You know, is it the house you live in? Is it society? And sort of over the generations, you can see different writers shift in that locus of horror. And here, I suppose, for me, it would be the room. I love the relationship between space and light. And I remember first reading this poem, just thinking of all of this white light. And there's a wonderful irony in it. There's a lot of light, but there's no colour, really. The light is glaring. It's creeping round curtain edges. It's this sort of almost overwhelming, unpleasant white glare. And of course, you know, the mind blanks at the glare. The furnace fear is another one that the kind of eye lingers around when you read that. It's very much, you know, that creeping sense of cremation and that the event of the funeral and the fact that you're going to be going through that soon. But it's something that you, even though, as he says very clearly, you can't. A rational person can't fear, that's what he doesn't know. This is nevertheless what you fear, is that particular journey. So I've always been struck by the element of light in here and the lack of colour, the bland defying. It's almost as if light blanches, strips of any colour or emotion, the existence within this room. And also space, it's almost as if light can control, would it be too far to say that light controls the space? Slowly light strengthens and the room takes shape. It's almost as if the light itself is building this shell, this kind of prison where this rumination kind of twirls and winds round and round. But I absolutely agree with Joe that it's a journey. and it takes you through several stages of the fear. It's almost like it kind of bisects and dissects fear in a way and lays the different types of fear out on the table in five neat stanzas and, you know, lays them all out for prosecution in their own sense. Because
it's an unending journey, isn't it? Because
the patient
go from doctor to house to house, and then he goes to work and works all day and gets half drunk.
At night. And that opening is the only thing where there might be a glimmer of humour when we're going back to talking about if there's any humour there, because it does have the irony of somehow being the opening lyric of a blues song. And it when you first read the poem and you get that, you think you're in a different territory. You think you're going to be going down a different kind of road. And then the poem very quickly folds back to a Larkin rumination. And it's almost as if at that moment, he needs to beguile us. if he opened the poem straight away with furnace fear and with death being more withstood, we would kind of back off. But he's got this kind of popular catch-all beaty thing which enrolls us, and then we're locked in so quickly that we don't even see the humour really involved in that process.
And the only other part that I feel has a tiny bit of humour, again, depends on your sense of humour, I suppose, being brave lets no one off the grave. It's that slightly sing-songy approach. But the fact that it's happening at the end of the line and we have that enjambment drop and being brave being the end of the line, and it's like being brave, no, it lets no one off the grave. It's cute that you would try to do that.
Yeah.
But you can't escape.
It reminds me, like the graves are fine and private place, but none, I think, do their grace. You know, there's a kind of, like the metaphysical poets using that kind of rhyming and sort of humour to make
it. It is, isn't it? It's the humour. It's like almost like an Oscar Wilde epigram, being brave, let no one off the grave. Yeah. I can just imagine if I said that to someone on the street, as Larkin said, being brave, let no one off the grave, they would laugh because it's such a neat little ironic nugget.
You could sort of say it in hospital, couldn't you, when they're prepping you for surgery or something. Like, chance about to be brave, and you could go, you can hear him saying, being brave, let's no one off the grave.
And in a way, to bring it round to that as well, I love the fact that, you're so right, Alex, this idea that this fear is multi-sided, and we get to see these different sides of it, almost as if to say everything that you might want to try to do is futile. And obviously, as we would expect from Larkin, he puts the boot into religion in the third stanza in such a withering way. Religion used to try. I love that, because it's this idea that what it used to try, it's almost not worth talking about, but if he is going to talk about it, he calls it the vast moth-eaten musical brocade. You know, it's just so withering about all dogma there, really. One fell swoop, he manages to create this sense that it's this musical brocade. It's a load of, as he would say, balls. It doesn't have any bearing on what happens next. And the fact that it's a special way of being afraid, it's saying that it doesn't matter your faith, it doesn't matter your belief system. You are, and again, this is where myself being very much an atheist and I feel quite strongly about it, it is something that scares me in the future. I'm jealous of those that have faith because it must be nice to have something there should you become unwell and should you, you know, be facing death in that as an immediate thing. It must be lovely to have that. So he's almost letting us share in his fear of this lack of belief system as well, which I, you know, it's very generous of him.
Yeah, it's you're so right about that line. It's like a drops mic moment, isn't it, for all of religion. I mean, all of, you know, the Christopher Hitchens debates on atheism, you know, you could sum up the power in just that little bit. It's just so withering. And it's so curt and concise and sharp in typical Larkin way that it is followed on with a sort of weird expanding out, isn't it? And an overstatement. He enumerates all the different ways we're not going to feel and we're not going to sense. I mean, in a way, it's obvious, isn't it? It's like no sight, no sound, no touch or taste or smell, nothing to link with. I mean, it's an overstatement, whereas the equally powerful was just preceded it, is this wonderfully pithy, concise. And I think that's generally what Larkin does so well, and you don't see it at first, is that he will make very slick little nuggets of a very big concept that he will sort of discharge with a boom. And then just when you're reeling from that, he will open out and sort of concertina outwards something that seems quite simple for an equally similar effect.
And it has that sort of broad similarity or homage almost to the Seven Ages of Man.
Yeah.
You know, this idea of the sans teeth, sans eyes, etc. You know, there is, I'm sure it's probably deliberate, but it's a reworking of that. It's a reworking of this to say, actually, this is proving an absence, of course, is always tricky in poetry, but he does it with aplomb. And then, of course, to then link it to the metaphorical anesthetic, the anesthetic from which none come round. It's that sense that this is all a numbing agent, which is probably the only real comfort we get in a way. But even though he does say, this is what we fear, is this numbing agent of nothingness.
And the fact that he ends those lines with nothing to love or link with, and he also talks later about, you know, this fear comes over is when we're caught without people or dream. You know, and it's easy to see Larkin as a sort of poet of isolation, but here he says, you know, it's the removal of myself from the people around me that is terrifying, that permanent removal of people.
It reminds me slightly of that Verdi Society line where he says, and sitting, God, I forget the exact line now, but he says, it brings not peace, but other things. And again, it's that lack of specificity of what are these other things. And one thing that I really love in the penultimate stanza is this slight hint of the ghostly, but it's never on the nose. And so it stays just on the edge of vision, a small unfocused blur, a standing chill. That for me feels very, I'm almost reminded of the M.R. James story, A Warning to the Curious, with this ghostly wraith-like figure of William Ager, who he says he has some power over your eyes. It's like this just on the edge of your vision. Mm. He's always there. This sense of haunting, you know, this idea of being haunted by this fear of death, and this realization rages out when we're caught with other people or drink, you know, this idea that every now and again suddenly it hits you. And I can relate to that. You know, we wake up at silly o'clock in the morning for no apparent reason and then lie there in the dark thinking, shit.
And that's when lots of people sort of report seeing ghosts, isn't it? They wake up in the night. I mean, I had this strangely happen to me a couple of weeks ago, and I've told a few members of my family, but I woke up in the night and I looked over, and just above the headboard, there was a face of an old woman.
Shit.
It was really bizarre. And I kind of blinked and then she went. But I could see, that's I looked weird. At her quite carefully because I was thinking, that's a woman's face looking at me.
That's so strange.
It was really strange. We live in a Victorian house and we both had little instances of seeing, particularly in the kitchen, that the cellar is like on the same level as the kitchen at the other side of the stairs. And we've both seen like black figures. And we think it's my youngest, who just wears all black all the time. And I think he's gone in to get some crisps or something. And then it's not her. She hasn't come down the stairs. But I've definitely seen some black shape moving in.
On a slight tangent, how are we all aligned when it comes to the supernatural? What's our sort of baseline on this? Because I can imagine how Larkin felt.
I think it's something that it's part of like human existence to think what happens to us after we die. I really like ghost stories, and I really like reading about ghost stories. And I like, if someone says to me, I woke up in the night and saw this, I find it fascinating, and we all kind of find it fascinating when each of us does that. But I could never sit here and say I believe in ghosts. I don't really. Mm. I don't really know what they are, but I think they are something, not necessarily an external existence of some soul that hasn't left this earth, but there's something happening because they're in every culture throughout human civilization. So they are fulfilling something in our minds in some way. What about you, Alex? Mr. Ghost Tour?
I used to do ghost tours for about 10 years. So I'm naturally interested, fascinated in ghosts and particularly old things and old cities. I suppose it sort of aligns with the fact that I'm probably 90% atheist and 10% agnostic. There's that tiny little bit at the top that is wondering, what if?
Yeah.
And again, there's a wonderful Larkin line that makes sense of it all in Church Going when he says, you know, people will always be surprising in themselves, you know, this desire to find for something greater than them. And it's, I think it's something intrinsic about the human psyche to want there to be something above them. People don't sit well with thinking they're at the top. In a way, we need some to feel there's something on top. So there's always going to be this gravitational pull in the psyche for us to believe that. Have I actually ever seen anything? A couple of things? Yes, but I always think I was probably at that particular moment. It was a trick of the light. It was it was this, it was that. This new flat we're in, Ellie and I have both seen what seems to be the ghost of a cat. We're convinced we've both seen this ghost of a cat. But, you know, I can happily, you know, I can happily admit that that would have been a flicker that was a figment of my brain. But I think what's interesting is at this point, it's a kind of nice segue really to the other poems, because we're starting to approximate dreaming, aren't we? We're starting to occupy that twilight world between the lived and the awakened world fear, such as in Obard, and the type of horror and gothic that is the stuff of nightmare, dream, this sort of suspended consciousness, which I think is very much something that's employed by Larkin in many ways. And then I suppose you're more in the territory of the gothic, aren't you?
Yeah.
With the subconscious, the doubling, particularly in Jill, I think there's a typical kind of instance of monomania, this obsessing over one single idea, this one idea, this one notion that you get preoccupied with. It's such a sort of preserve of the turn of the century kind of, you know, fantastical literature. I'll always be, Joe, about ghosts.
I'm very jealous of anyone that's ever seen anything, because I can say hand on heart, I've never had a supernatural experience of any kind, but then I don't think I'm open to it. And that's possibly, I mean, I listen to all sorts of spooky podcasts. I love Halloween and Christmas ghost stories, all that sort of stuff. But the way I see it, I think some people are tuned in to a certain frequency and others just aren't. That's my very sort of boring thought on it, because my wife, for example, I think is very tuned into this kind of stuff. And though we haven't touched wood, seen anything here, we live in a new build house, I'd be quite shocked if there was any sort of remnants. Well, yes. However, we did once stay in this very, very old Tudor place, and she woke in the night to see a face directly opposite hers in the darkness, this woman's face, and it was talking, but she couldn't hear what it was saying. She sort of moved backwards, and then it just faded into the darkness. And she's convinced that it was probably a dream, but she said it really felt, she said, I was awake, but I can't tell if I was already awake.
Strange.
I know. And I'm lying next to her snoring, you know, not without a care in the world.
Yeah.
But no, again, and, you know, to bring it round a little bit to sort of what, you know, Larkin would, I'm sure, have shrugged off any mention of the supernatural in some ways. But in a way, this sort of brings us into the idea of the gothic. Some of the best ghost stories, I would argue, the best spooky stories, rely on having a skeptic as your narrator.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it lends us, they become, they're the audience surrogate. Mm. And the fact that they don't believe means that something has to prove itself. The burden of proof is then on that thing. Obviously, M.R. James does this. It's a huge effect. Pretty much all of his main characters are stuffy academic types, maybe even librarians in one case. You know, so there is that element there of, you know, the ordered, structured world, of course, which Larkin very much inhabits, and then this world on the fringes that doesn't quite play by the rules that he would set out. So I think that there's some currency in that, maybe.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? About it's this thing of the Lockwood effect from Wuthering Heights, isn't there? You know, probably one of the best romantic ghostish books of all time opens, "I've just returned from a visit to my landlord." It's so prosaic and dull, and you're in the company of quite a dull guy who is entering this crazy moorland family world, and you need him to kind of calibrate you at the outset. It's very interesting.
That's another opening chapter that is full of humour as well. You know, when he goes into the kitchen and accidentally sits on the kittens and gets into all sorts of scrapes. before the real horror begins.
And it's also interesting what Joe said. There's this weird kind of paradox, in so much as real, if we think of real horror, you know, your real murderers, if you go back in history, thinking of Jack the Rippers, or you're kind of the people in society who do actually commit real things, they tend to be kind of lower on this sort of educational kind of achievement spectrum and social misfits. And yet in the Gothic, they're these very erudite men, Dr. Frankenstein's, you know, Hannibal Lecter, Jekyll and Hyde, all doctors, you know, all kind of, you know, at the apogee of kind of sort of human achievement, who are the ones that either conduct or find themselves sort of inveigled in the absolutely kind of crazy world of horror. Whereas in reality, you know, these aren't the typical types of people who will be.
I don't know. Harold Shipman. But
Harold Shipman, that's true. That came to my tongue the moment I said that left my mouth. Yeah, Harold Shipman.
Although I know what you mean, probably more the exception than the rule. And yet, I guess we are fascinated by duplicity. And so certainly, if you think of the media in the past couple of years, sort of there's been that debate of, should we really be bringing to life, you know, the Ted Bundy tapes as a form of entertainment?
Yeah.
And of course, very, very recently, Steve Coogan is going to be playing Savile in a BBC adaptation. And there's just a tiny bit of you that goes, is that a darkness that shouldn't be played around with and messed with in any way, shape or form?
That's true horror, isn't it, Jimmy?
True, yeah.
True, yeah. It's almost a different league to the sort of horror that I'm thinking back to the sort of video nasty scandals of the 60s and 70s, when films were kind of, you know, attempted to be censored because the horror in them was so profound. Oh, one of them, I'm not sure which one it was, it's the Italian director. He was immediately arrested for making a kind of neo-Gothic film until he could prove that all of his actors were actually alive and well, and they were
Cannibal ratting. Holocaust.
Yes, real. So real was this, you know, but that's the thing. It's the very similitude of Savile, isn't it? It's the fact that in the weird way, the real horror, the real things are like Obard. They're the things in our midst that we're all going to face. They're not the eating, jumping, boo kind of eviscerating, torturous stuff. They are the people in our midst who are doing some of these things, but right under our noses, beyond our ken. That's the real terror.
The banality of evil, I believe, is the phrase. The fact that evil things can be happening right, like you say, right under our nose with no comeuppance.
Yeah.
And you know, there's all of that sort of side angle to it. You know, we like a good scare when there's something supernatural that's almost blameless. You know, you can't you can't be angry at Michael Myers. He's completely insane, and he's come back home. You know, the story works like that. And yet the idea of a serial killer in real life, we go, geez, what happened there? How did he slip through the net? You know, we all enjoy the idea of something scary happening, because it's sort of sanitized and away. Yeah. One thing that I want to talk about, if it's okay, is ambulances, because I feel that I see ambulances in some ways has a lot of echoes within Obard.
Yeah.
In terms of the So some of the lines I've got here, the all streets in time are visited, I feel is very similar or has real echoes of the postman like doctors go from house to house. The sense that nowhere is safe, nowhere is you know, off limits, as it were. I still remember a very vivid memory. I used to work for the ambulance service before I became a teacher. And obviously, I've still got some friends who are paramedics, and I sort of know what the calls and codes look like, and how people are, you know, getting out there as quick as they can. Obviously, there's that real sense again with religion, with the closed like confessionals line, and something shameful being sort of, you know, carried in and stowed, as he puts it. But I still remember coming home. We're talking years ago now, and I was driving down this very, very long main road towards where my parents lived, and it's a bit of a cul-de-sac. And as I'm driving down, I see an ambulance pulled up outside my parents' house with blue lights on and the back open. And I just thought, oh, my word. And I just remember that distinct drop of my heart. Thankfully, it was outside my parents' house, but that's because our next-door neighbour, a very elderly lady, had a fall, sadly, and she'd broken her hip, and so they called an ambulance to take her away to the fracture clinic. But just in that moment, that thought of, oh, my word, this is real. And, you know, when you know how these things operate and you know how the crews sort of do their job, to them it is a job. It has to be very, very clinical, very clean, very unemotional. And yet when you're on the other end of it, and you've got these the children strewn on steps or road, women coming from the shops, and then there's this pretty horrific, I feel, or at least jarring contrast with the wild white face that overtops red stretcher blankets momently. It's this naked look at death, or near death at least. Again, and this links with the Gothic, the fear of illness, of disease, of being infirm, and
I was just to say, it's this weird thing with the white again, the white face, like, you know, Bard, almost like it's flipping white as this colour of purity, you know, the everlasting, onto its head as this sort of harbinger of death. But it's almost moving the horror into the symbol, isn't it? Because the ambulance it's a metonymy for something. It represents a whole raft of horrors that are down the line. It itself is just a vehicle, but it's enough to set in motion that runaway of horrific imaginings. Which I think goes back to what we were saying. He runs the gamut of types of horror, doesn't he? He sees horror in symbol, he sees horror in the grotesque, in the Gothic, and in the everyday. But I mean, that face coming out, you know, you just know it, don't you? You just know the it's the focus of that scene so much.
Yeah.
And then that you get that poor soul, they whisper at their own distress. And so again, in that sort of nugget of a symbol, you then get the hypocrisy which we all feel when we see something terrible happening like that. Our reaction is quite often, I'm really glad that isn't me. There's a catharsis straight away to that.
It's interesting, the catharsis, actually, because sometimes I think Larkin actually enacts sort of what's the sort of Aristotelian catharsis with horror, in so much as if you present horror in an artistic form or you dramatize it, there's this idea that as us, the readers, perhaps even him, the poet, actually purges the horror from you. It's that old kind of Aristotle notion, and I suppose kind of taken up with Theatre of the Absurd and Brecht and all of that, that if you are presented with a theatrical iteration of something ghastly, somehow it leads to a kind of an instance of soul searching or something that purges that from you, which is kind of, I see as If My Darling is a little bit of a poem like that. It's a kind of identikit horror movie. And it's almost as if Larkin is trying to get out of his own head this sense of rumination, this knotted thought around this issue. If he could only write it down, he would cure somehow the horror.
This is now, we're now right inside Larkin, aren't we? Sort of inside his head. And if you kind of argue that ambulances and O'Bard is looking out at the world, it's just at his curtains. Mm. If my darling is literally like, he's turning his eyeballs around, isn't he? And imagining what he would see inside himself. Which is an interesting exercise.
One that we probably shouldn't be too ready to go to on ourselves. Their madness lies.
Oh, definitely. You know. And especially at this time when things weren't going too well for him in his life with a little bit of disruption around, trying to find his way in his career. And things were very difficult this time with Ruth. Of course, the collected poems, when you read when you look at the collected poems and you can see the date when things were written, it's hard not to put some of these poems into their kind of historical context. I know you don't always want to do that, but I do think If My Darling, it's a bit hard not to slightly psychoanalyze.
It is. Really. I mean, he was at Leicester, wasn't he? Yeah. And it was Ruth Bowman, the marriage. Was it the marriage that fell through?
Yeah, I think he proposed to her, but then kind of retracted it. And got ring back and
awkward.
I think at this point she was pretty fed up with him. And although I think he was trying to keep some kind of relationship with her, I think at this point she was pretty fed up with him. And I think he this poem is probably a reaction to that, maybe I'm not a great person when you look inside me. And when you look at the poem sort of written around about that time, he does talk about wanting, the next poem that he wrote is once about wanting to be alone, wanting to get away from everything, a desire for oblivion. But you don't write that kind of stuff when you're just, pottering along.
Tip-top and happy.
Yeah.
No.
We've got the reading of If My Darling, which I'm going to play, but you can read it again if you want, Alex, as a more straightforward reading. That would be good.
I'll just read it now. I happen to have my page here. So, If My Darling. If my darling were once to decide not to stop at my eyes, but to jump, like Alice, with floating skirt into my head, she would find no tables and chairs, no mahogany claw-footed sideboards, no undisturbed embers. The tantalus would not be filled, nor the fender seat cosy, nor the shelves stuffed with small printed books for the Sabbath, nor the butler bibless, the housemaid's lady. Lazy, she would find herself looped in a creep of varying light, monkey brown, fish grey, a string of infected circles loitering like bullies about to coagulate. The illusions that shrink to the size of a woman's glove, then sicken inclusively outwards. She would also remark the unwholesome floor, as it might be the skin of a grave, from which ascends an adhesive sense of betrayal. A Grecian statue kicked in the privates, money, swill tub of finer feelings. But most of all, she'd be stopping her ears against the incessant recital intoned by a reality, larded with technical terms, each one double-yoked with meaning and meaning's rebuttal. The skirl of that bulletin unpicks the world like a knot. And to hear how the past is past and the future neuter might knock my darling off her unpriceable pivot. So I think what really stands out, this poem, is that line, for me, what really kicks it all off, is that line, no mahogany claw-footed sideboards. I don't know why, but I think in a lot of horror, a lot of Larkin, you get the traditional English scene of the interior, the drawing room, the kind of topi, I suppose you'd call them, the different facets of English gentility. You get it in Jill as well, and in Basil Collins's Basil, a scene of domesticity, English pride, and then that is overturned very quickly. And that is where the horror originates from. That is the setting for horror. It's almost something like, don't you ever think you're too secure in your British grandeur and your conquering of all the ways and your empire? This is the very area you're most at risk in for the intrusion of the horror, because you have no mahogany claw-footed sideboards. I love how mahogany is this, you know, endangered wood, the sign of opulence, and then claw-footed, immediately there's that gargoyle-esque, in just those two words, butted up against each other, that claw-footed sideboards. You needn't describe them in that way. You needn't focus on that particular detail. But that particular detail has been extracted because it's so resonant of something else, some talon-like, something scratching at your heart, you know, something, you know, that is unpleasant and you want to fight off. And that, in a nutshell, for me, is the poem as a whole. It is all taking place in the setting of British gentility, comfort, and yet it's on every turn. In that, like a kind of magic eye puzzle, you see this lurking figure that is something else. I just think it's a lovely kind of expression of the extent to which symbolism can evoke horror, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And also that idea of going from the civilized and having this just latent savagery under the surface, very, very gothic. And also interesting as well with the idea of the British opulence. I guess if we were to take Larkin's sort of pretty rampant jingoism into consideration here as well, he's not afraid to sort of put the boot in and really sort of say, hang on a minute, how should this be? How could this look? I do love the Grecian statue kitchen, the privates. I think it's marvellous. Such a wonderful line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's our nugget of humour, isn't it? That's that's the moment you take your breath and you can readjust in your seat. Because, yeah, there's got to be something that keeps you aware that Larkin is having fun to a degree. He's playing with you. You need to see him enough to know that you're in the company of a master, kind of beguiling figure. Figure of beguilement? Is that such a
thing? I like the image.
You convince me.
The unwholesome floor with the adhesive, like the skin of a grave, the adhesive sense of betrayal, you know, the kind of sticky floor. There's something really, and it's actually betrayal, and I don't know, it's almost like a sort of mixed metaphor, isn't it? The sticky floor of betrayal. And it's quite ludicrous if you talk about it in too much detail, really, but it's also quite sinister as well.
It is, yeah.
And I really find the monkey brown fish grey and the string of infected circle, I don't even quite know what he's trying to describe, but it kind of makes me think of like disease and kind of coagulating kind of
there's a real sense of body horror, isn't there?
Just words, monkey brown and fish grey, they're all wrong. They kind of don't, fish grey is a horrible
fish grey, it would never be a Farron Ball colour, would it? Fish grey. It would be it would be something like, you know, Highland grey,
or,
you know, downpipe grey, something evocative. Fish grey is almost specifically engineered to make grey seem utterly ghastly somehow.
Yeah, it's sort of decomposing fish or something, isn't it?
Yes, it's not decomposing. Fresh. It's that kind of grey, sort of lifeless, sort of leaden, like the leaden sky. It's interesting you mentioned the sense of betrayal, because Lynn mentioned sense of betrayal just there. But when I read it, I really sort of was arrested by that, because is it me or is betrayal not really something that Larkin deals much with? I mean, he does in his personal letters talk about his past and how he felt maybe, you know, he didn't get the best start, violence in a father, a kind of very retiring, quiet mother. But you never, it just struck me, because betrayal doesn't seem to be a common theme in Larkin's work, but I could just be missing something blindingly obvious. Mm. And I like that, because that gives it that authenticity, the fact that this is an exclusive sitting. It's an exclusive read, members only, almost. Mm. You're really getting Larkin where he's plumbing the depths of his past and his soul and how it's all kind of fixing together or falling apart into something that is ghastly.
I think in a way that... Oh, sorry. Sorry, Lynn.
Like, he's the person that's doing the portrayal, though, isn't he?
Mm. Yes, he is in this instance, of course, with Dear Old Ruth. Yeah.
The way I read it. And, you know, in the Dante circles of hell, it's the it's Judas at the very bottom, isn't it? It's the betrayer that's, you know, often considered the worst sort of humanity. And all right, it's just been turned into a sticky floor, an unwholesome floor. It makes me think of all the nightclubs I used to go to in the early 90s. But it's visceral, it's there, it's a real what is inside him.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
I was just going to say, in terms of betrayal and jealousy, which again is something which is not in as high demand or in as high abundance as you might think with the type of poet that Larkin was. For me, there is a small amount of vulgar horror, if you like, in Love Again. The opening line, Love Again, wanking at 3:10. I mean, it's hilarious in a way, but then obviously we get this hot bedroom and the pain and, you know, the vulgar way he describes her body. It's it's very ugly and sort of, you know, gives you an, again, I know, again, he's acting as a persona, but equally it's not, we know it's Larkin down. So
And I think that's what I like about Larkin. I know I've talked about this before, about the use of sort of swear words and things like that. He's very like muscular in his language. He's very he wasn't restrained by, you know, the politeness of, you know, upper middle class England. And the, you know, he used the words he needed to use, didn't he?
Yeah, he didn't, you know, he, there's a often a sort of a wrongful fallacy really levelled against people who use swear words. It's quite old fashioned now and seen as that, thankfully, but you know, that your vocabulary is scant if you're using swear words, but you know, not at all. There've been studies now, haven't they, that people who swear, you know, regularly actually on the whole have a slightly higher IQ, if anything. But it's that sense that he knows when to use it and when he seems to have such an exquisite understanding of the minute power of a word. Mm. I mean, I just love just a sort of word level, you know, sometimes even a syllable level, the effect is so strong. Just, she would find herself looped with the creep of varying light. Creep, it's, you know, the creep of varying light's a weird kind of use of the word for a noun. Does light a creep of light? I suppose you could have a creep of light, but what you go to quicker is the idea of a creep, a stalking, malevolent person, a weirdo, someone who's unsavory. And it's that sort of conflating of the two different sort of types, which I think he's very good at in poems like this.
A nice link there with the building as well. As well as creepers hangs a frightening smell.
Yes, yeah.
The sense of, again, we know, obviously, this, again, the building is almost like the natural companion to ambulances, because that's where they end up. So the sense of, you know, what keep drawing up at the entrance are not taxis. Again, there's that not something, which is what adds to the sort of vagary of it, and yet makes it definitely more compelling.
Yeah. It's a rhetorical device, isn't it? Going back eons, antanagogue, to describe things through their absence and say, we are not doing this, we're not doing this, we're not doing this, we're not doing this. And therefore, in the utmost part of, you know, the electorate's mind are those things.
Yeah.
It's so politicians, like, yeah.
It's like, I remember, you know, when he talks about the things that happened to him in his childhood. It's like that here, isn't it? This is not what you're going to find, but in fact you are thinking about those things. I thought the reference to Alice is interesting, and I don't know if Larkin made any other references to Alice in Wonderland. I know he liked you know, Beatrix Potter, and he was very interested in sort of children's stories in that respect. Mm. But Alice, I don't know what position Alice played in the 1950s. It probably seemed a little bit, you know, like during World War II, people were not very interested in kind of fantasy and ghost stories, for example, because there was just too much going on in the real world around you. There's a little kind of flirtation with Alice here in 1950.
Arresting it, the fact that she makes that appearance there so early on, and there's that attention around the floating skirt into my head. Mm. Again, there's this always this thing with Larkin. There's a sort of queasy mixture of metaphors, descriptions, and that which doesn't sit right. But almost that's what's inducting us in this poem. We are in the territory of the queasy, unpleasant, that kind of grey twilight era. We're not sure that
the fish grey occupying.
Yes, area, yeah. the fish grey zone. And I suppose Alice is the perfect corollary though for this poem, if you think about it, because it is Alice in Wonderland is obviously a sort of fantastical conceit. It's an adventure from something which is very everyday into something which is supernatural. But there's this horror and terror that is always lurking with Alice, isn't there? You're never quite sure. There's something grotesque about it.
Yeah.
So I suppose it could be a sort of a nice sort of subtext. But it's weird at the same time to get Alice there, just as we're about to enter in this poem about love and about, you know, as Lynn said, that kind of connects in Larkin's life to a forward through engagement.
Yeah, you really don't want to put Alice into that context.
You don't want Alice there, no.
I feel very sorry for Alice that she's ended up in Philip Larkin's head. Mm. It's not where you want her to go, really.
Thank you so much to Alex and Mr. James for being our spirit guides today. We actually had so much more to talk about that I'm already planning Horror Larkin Part 2 for October next year. Thank you also to Mr. Wes Finch, who provided the wonderfully spooky original music for us, as well as the reading of If My Darling that we heard at the start of the show, with editorial assistance from Ben Haynes. The reading also featured Jules Street and John Parker from the band playing their instruments in a wonderfully creepy way. Thank you for all your wonderful work with this. It sounds absolutely amazing. This podcast was produced by Simon Galloway, and the podcast Twitter account is supported by Laura Wilson. If you'd like to support the podcast, as always, you can head to philiplarkin.com and join the society, make a donation, subscribe to the free newsletter, or buy some merchandise. Thank you for all the tweets and emails. Please keep them coming in. I'm always interested in hearing from anyone who might like to get involved with producing the podcast or who has an idea for a guest or an episode. So if that's you, please get in touch.